Welcome. The topic of this seminar is religious censorship in the information age, given by Brother Francis Nathop. Brother Francis Nathop is an educational director of the David Cardozo Academy in Jerusalem and is a well-respected educator who has had positions in education both in Yeshiva University and the Shechbar Sephardic Study Center and the Chappelle College of Jewish Studies. His degrees from YU are in international affairs, Jewish history, and of course, ordination from YU. He's written news articles for a variety of important Jewish websites, periodicals that have come out recently, and his first book is entitled The Meaning of Relevance in the Book of Genesis, Explanations in Text and Meaning. So we welcome Rabbi Nathop to our community.
Thank you, Rabbi Levy. Last night, I shared feelings of guilt with some of you who were there. I spoke about guilt, my guilt feelings about living in a segregated community, a community that is almost entirely all Orthodox in Israel, Har Nof in Jerusalem. Today, I want to share feelings of insecurity. I also organize various conferences for my own school, the David Cardozo Academy in Israel. And it's truly an art to put a schedule together strategically. And I wonder, I didn't speak to the sponsors, how they decided who should speak first, who should speak last. But I wonder what sort of strategy they had in mind by putting me at the end of the day. I know that in Eidah, conferences, what they often would do is to put the most outstanding speakers at the end, most charismatic, Rabbi Riskin. I think the last international conference that Eidah had in New York was what we call a cleanup speaker. And obviously the idea was to keep everyone present. So I know that's not the case today. The image that I get instead is what I remember from going to baseball games when I was in the United States. The scenario of the home team or the other team winning 10-1 in the ninth inning and having everybody sort of mosey on home and not needing to see the final inning. So I feel like I'm in that situation right now. But hopefully what we have to say will be of some importance and of will reward those who decided to stay through the last inning this afternoon. I want to thank the hosts, Torah Motion, Professor Malamud, Rabbi Kelman, for inviting me to speak this afternoon throughout the conference, and to be involved with such a distinguished group of speakers. Not only are they distinguished and erudite, but I think we've had tremendous entertainment value. A lot of interesting stories, funny jokes. I don't know that I'll be able to provide you with that either. I was once told that the measure of fluency in a foreign language is whether you're able to tell a joke in that language. Now, I happen to speak four languages reasonably well, but if that's the test of fluency, then I'm not sure I'm fluent in English either. But in any case, you'll make do. The topic of religious censorship has been a topic that has become very contested, very debated in the last number of years. I actually spoke about this first before the Slifkin affair, but even before the Slifkin affair, there were other books that had been banned, and it created relatively minor controversies in comparison with the Slifkin affair, but still shook up a lot of people and created a lot of not only discussion, but rancor, disharmony within our ranks. I refer to a friend of ours, friend of the Cardozo Academy's chief rabbi of England, Sir has been knighted, I understand, Rabbi Sir Jonathan Sacks, who unfortunately I could only get the second edition of his book, Dignity of Difference. I noticed it was on sale here. I'm not sure which edition, but I assume it's the second edition, and what I mean by first and second, the first edition drew criticism, especially among English rabbis in the Haredi community, where certain things that he said about the possibility of revelation to other religions besides Judaism was taken, I don't know if it was taken the wrong way, but was stepped on a lot of people's toes and ruffled feathers, and he went, as a result, he got into some hot water. The course that he chose to take on this, Rabbi Sacks, and obviously he's under a lot of political pressure as the chief rabbi, it's not like in the United States where you can afford to have, or in Canada for that matter, where you can have, afford to have different leaders saying different positions. The chief rabbi has to be representative of all English Jewry, so he chose to give in on some level to the pressure, and he wrote a second edition. And in the introduction, if anyone has it, or it's a good read, even in the revised edition, he says in his introduction that he was concerned that people would misread his intentions and therefore clarified what he had to say. Again, certainly Rabbi Sacks' choice, and perhaps what he did was the right thing. This was followed, even before I spoke the first time in Jerusalem about 3 years ago, by another band, that of Rav Nathan Kamenetsky, whose son was, is actually a friend of ours, who's also involved in the controversy. The book that he put out, also fairly famous, called The Making of a Gadol, which was a very honest and somewhat revealing portrayal of Lithuanian rabbinic leadership in its heyday. And the honest portrayals of some of the up-and-coming leaders, especially Rav Aaron Cutler, but many others, the truth is, in their youth and their formative years, was something that, again, ruffled many feathers in the Haredi world. And as a result, Rav Nathan Kamenetsky, who, as opposed to Rabbi Sacks, really is part of that world, was taken to task and suffered a great personal price, really disturbed his health, for writing this book. And he also, like Rabbi Sacks, decided to publish a second edition, which is now available. And in his case, he calls it, there's a red stripe on the side, if you're familiar, it's called the improved edition. And he also, in his foreword, explains why there's a need for an improved edition. Of course, all of this pales to the affair that happened more recently, and I understand it only hit Toronto a year after everybody else was involved, and I refer to the Slifkin affair. Rabbi Slifkin, of course, is a well-known figure to this audience, not only having spoken here, but having been in the news. He also happens to be a teacher of ours. He teaches for us on a fairly regular basis at the Cardozo Academy in Yerushalayim. The affair was different than the other two, primarily for the reason that Rabbi Slifkin, be it out of naivete, be it out of personal courage, decided to stick with his books and did not take them off the shelves and did not revise them. I mean, he wrote new books that come in the footsteps and are an improvement, but he didn't back down from continuing to sell the books that had gotten banned. What he did was to find a different publisher who was present at the conference today, Rabbi Student. In any case, Rabbi Slifkin, the affair that he was involved with became much more involved in argument, much bit more bitter, much more universal. In fact, some of you are aware that the story made the New York Times, it was a science section of the New York Times. It was actually, it wasn't a short piece, it was a lengthy piece that discussed the whole issue. It was actually a good article, it was fairly balanced. But in any case, this took the whole Jewish world by storm. And I can't help but comment on what was said. Some of you might have also been at the panel and discussion that occurred a couple hours ago. Rabbi Berziger made a comment that I felt it was necessary to comment upon. By and large, I felt very honored to be with Rabbi Berziger, and I appreciated many things that he has to say and his approach in general, I think, have much in common. But the notion that the Slifkin affair is out of proportion, that we're paying too much attention to it, I'm not sure I would agree with. I think that at this point in time, things have blown over to the point where the hatchets have been buried and life will continue, but I think the potential, the historic potential of this affair was tremendously historical. I think that it could have, and I think should have, changed the face of Orthodoxy. I think that it revealed the hashkafa, the approach of the Haredi leadership and the modern Orthodox movement should have made much more publicity, much more effort to capitalize on determining the course of Orthodoxy when it comes to the debate between modern Orthodoxy and Haredi youth for the future of Judaism. I'm not a pluralist. I think that ultimately there are different worldviews, and one of them is going to be more correct than the other, and if modern Orthodoxy wants to have the upper hand, it was a mistake not to make more of this affair. But it's interesting, as I discussed the Slifkin affair when it was a few months old at EIDA, the EIDA conference, and it was, I was surprised that most of the people there had not even heard of the event, the scandal. But in any case, as I said, this discussion really precedes and antecedes, it's important before Slifkin and after Slifkin. It's an issue that I think is more classical. There's really an important issue at hand on the essential level and perhaps on the halakhic level, and we're going to take somewhat of a halakhic approach to the issue. And when I speak about censorship, I would imagine that in an audience like this, a lot of us would feel a certain gut revulsion, even to the term, bothered by the idea, even without thinking it through, what is censorship and what is it about? And I think that as objective, mature religious Jews, we can't afford such a knee-jerk liberal position. I don't think to be modern means to automatically be liberal. I'm speaking about classical liberalism. I'm not even speaking about liberal conservative on the political, on the modern political spectrum, but rather classical liberalism in terms of individual rights, such as freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that one has to automatically always attach oneself to liberal values when they are in conflict with Orthodoxy, simply to get the term modern Orthodox. In any case, I wanted to point out that there are very few of us, probably no one in this room, who believes in complete freedom of information. It would be a libertarian position on censorship. Just to give you a couple of obvious examples, we all have heard something called military censorship. It's well known that any country in a state of war has to keep things secretive. Those of you might remember in the last war that Israel had with Lebanon, there was a blackout on where missiles were being fired that hit Canada. But the Israeli media, especially after a couple of days into the war, were told not to report where the exact location of the hit from the missiles. The idea being that if the enemy would find out where their missiles were landing, they would be able to regulate the targeting more effectively. And therefore, this was a military secret. Military secret is simply a part of smart government. If you're going to fight a war, if you don't want to risk the lives of your soldiers, you have to keep troop deployments, you have to keep strategy, you can't keep all sorts of information secret. That may be self-evident. What may be a little less self-evident is nations don't always need to keep secrets from their enemies, even more frequently we need to keep information from ourselves. In other words, similar to the military situation that I described in the United States in World War II, there was a ban against gory depictions of the war, because it was felt that that would have a negative impact on morale. So there the view was that it's better to keep certain images, certain ideas, certain material away from the host population, as a government trying to protect its own citizenry by keeping information away from them. And this too, I think, we could debate, we could certainly see a validity to such censorship. And going into our own world, the world of halakha, this exists also in the halakha that's perhaps not well known, but some people who have been in the situation may be aware of it. The halakha exists, if you want to take notes, in Yeredeah, Siman, Shin Lamed Zayin, 337, that's in Yilchot, Bikur Cholim, that if there is a very sick individual, and one of his relatives dies while he's sick, the halakha is not supposed to tell them, because that would threaten their well-being. And if anyone doubts the wisdom of such halakha, one of my students had just such an event occur. Apparently, the people around my student's father were not aware of this halakha, and told them about a young man who he was very close to, was a close family friend, who had just committed suicide. And this student's father's health plunged immediately. And Baruch Hashem pulled out that this had a very negative impact on his health. So the halakha, knowing that information can sometimes be dangerous, sometimes, enforces a notion of censorship for the benefit of the person themselves. Right? Sometimes what we don't know is better for us, and it's better for us not to know something than to know it. So in fact, there is, I think we can all agree, no matter how liberal we are, and again, even outside of this room, that there is room for censorship. Censorship does have its place, and it's a healthy thing in certain situations. The only question is, where are those situations? I'm going to get to that, but before I do, there's another notion that I need to preface my main remarks with, and perhaps it's not necessary to do it here, simply the notion that halakha, that orthodox, traditional, normative halakha does develop and does change. Again, I'm assuming that a conference that's held by an organization that's called Torah in Motion, that I don't need to really belabor this point, that Torah does change and does develop. Anybody who has any serious amount of scholarship will recognize the phrase ha'idna. Anybody know what ha'idna means when I translate it for me?
Yes.
Now, okay, we find this word ha'idna in the Gemara. We find the word in the Shulchan Aruch. What it means is that there's a certain situation, a certain halakha, but now ha'idna is no longer relevant. Things have changed, therefore it's no longer relevant. I'll give you a couple of examples for those of you who are less versed in the literature of Talmud and halakha. There's a very interesting halakha, again, that many people are not aware of. Every man, it would appear that it's only on men, it's not 100% clear, but every man at least is obligated to either write or purchase a Sefer Torah. So I'm going to ask the men in the room, how many of you have fulfilled this mitzvah so far in your life? A show of hands? One person. Okay, the truth is, you probably all have, and you don't realize it. And I'll tell you why. The classical formulation is that you have to literally write or buy a literal Sefer Torah. But in the Middle Ages, there was a position taken by the Rosh. The Rosh is Rabbeinu Asher, one of the major pillars of halakha, one of the three Rishonim. that have the most weight in Shulchan Aruch. It's also mentioned in the name of earlier authorities of the Gaonim, which take the position that nowadays what we do to fulfill that mitzvah is not to buy or to write a Sefer Torah, but rather to purchase Chumashim, to purchase other Sifrei Kodesh like Gemarot, like Mishnayot. And the rationale is as follows, that the reason for the mitzvah, according to the Rush, is that we need something to study from. We need a text to study from. And at the time, there was no such thing as printed matter. There was only Sifrei Torah. Therefore, in order to study the written text, you would need a Sefer Torah. Says the Rush, and this is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, and it's given the stamp of approval by the majority of latter-day poskim, we call that Achronim, that this, in fact, has become the halakha that since we can learn the Torah even more easily, we don't have to wrestle with it with the Eitz Chaim and all this, it's easier for us to do the same, to accomplish the same goal with printed Sfarim, and therefore we accomplish the same mitzvah, perhaps even in a better way, by purchasing such books, such Sfarim, and therefore, according to this approach, which is normative halakha, we have all fulfilled this mitzvah. Now, I'm giving this example, I'll give you a couple more very quickly. I'm giving this example because I think it's a very radical example of a reformulation of halakha based on technological changes in society. And again, the phrase ha'idna, we're saying now things are different, and the halakha has to be reformulated. Not changed, not abandoned, but reformulated. This is an example of a technological change. What's even more interesting is when halakha responds to social change, and it really does. I'm giving two quick examples of that. One, again, from the classical period of the Rishonim, perhaps more well-known, some of you who are versed in halakha and Gemara, there's a Mishnah that tells us that a chatan, that a groom, is patur, is not obligated to read Kriyat Shema the night of his wedding. The rationale being that he's too preoccupied to concentrate on the mitzvah of saying the Shema. The Shema, we know, is a mitzvah that requires concentration. Again, halakhically speaking, requires concentration. And that concentration is simply unavailable to the young groom, and therefore he's not obligated in reading the Shema that evening. Came along the Tosafot in Amidmar, in the second paragraph of Birachot, and they say it doesn't apply to that. And the reasoning is also quite interesting. They say that nobody in their time has the real concentration level that used to be present in ancient classical times. And therefore, since no one really has that level of concentration, the chatan, the groom, will not be in any worse situation than anybody else. If we were to require that level of kavanah, of intention that was only available to ancients, then we would abandon the mitzvah of reading the Shema altogether. Since obviously we're not going to do that, there's no real difference, say Tosafot, between a groom and anyone else. And therefore, they too, the groom also, like anyone else, has to read the Shema. Okay? And again, this is something that's not only a radical reappraisal of the mitzvah, it's something that's normative and accepted in halakha. It's brought down to Shulchan Aruch. I'll read you the phrase that the Shulchan Aruch brings down the Mishnah almost verbatim, telling us that the chatan is, the groom is exempt from saying the Shema the night of his wedding, but he says like this, it continues, using the formulation of Rav Meir of Rotenberg, who's among the latter Tosafists, he says, these words are true in earlier times. Aval Akshav, right, again, Ha'idna is Akshav in Hebrew. Aval Akshav, but today, or rather Aramaic, Aval Akshav, Shegam Shav Ne'adam, Einam Mekavnim, Karavui, in our day, since everybody else also does not concentrate according to how they should, Gam akone et habitula
kore.
Even when someone who's marrying a woman who's a bitula, who's never been married before, should also read the Kriyat Shema, and that's part of the Shulchan Aruch. I don't have the citation, but it shouldn't be too difficult to find. Another example of this more recent times, lest you think this is only something that happened in medieval times, it happened among the greater poskim of our day, and part of my contention, if we get time for it, is that such poskim are more and more a thing of the past. But Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was certainly from the classical poskim, who lived very recently, I remember his funeral was not so long ago, and was accepted as an unusual man that was accepted in all circles. Very few people like that. Moshe Feinstein was another such individual. Very few people were accepted in all circles. Rosh Shlomo Zalman was such a man. And he writes in a volume called Mincha Shlomo, which is a responsa from him. There's halacha, and I'm sure this one is much less well known, partly because it's in part of Shulchan Aruch that is not familiar to most of us. And Evna Ezer, which speaks about laws between men and women. And over there, the Siman is Chaf Aleph, that's 21 Seif Aleph. Chapter 1, or item number 1, Shulchan Aruch tells us that it's forbidden to walk, for man to walk behind a woman. This is in the context of providing safeguards to prevent men from staring at women. And that's the halakha, that's the way it's brought down. Shulchan Zalman Auerbach comments that this may not apply today. And he gives the following reasoning, which is fascinating. Thought. He says that this was true when women were not found frequently on the street. This is also a situation where men were embarrassed to stare at women while looking at them. So neither of these things are true today. First of all, he says, it's very funny the way he phrased it, he says, you know, if you pass a woman up so as not to look at her, most likely you'll end up behind another woman. So it's not going to help you much. He says, besides that, the people that scare women nowadays are so unabashed that it doesn't make a difference to them whether they're behind them or in front of them. It's all the same. So in any case, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that halacha l'maaseh, he's a little hesitant. He said, I'm not going to say this as a blanket hit there, as a blanket allowance, but rather I will allow a man to walk behind a woman for the sake of the mitzvah. I'm not sure what the mitzvah would be, but he also says, also, this is typical of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, for nimusim, when it's polite to do so. Right? That if you're going to be rude by stepping, walking in front of a woman, whatever it is, then it's permissible, according to Shlomo Zalman, to walk behind one. And again, the point, not being a specific example, but rather the fact that halakha does develop not only in response to technological change, but also in response to social change. So the last example being a combination both of social attitudes as well as technological change, the fact that somewhere between technological and social, but simply women are more present in the public domain. I want to get on to the issue at hand. I just wanted to preface my remarks with two points. Number one, that sometimes censorship is appropriate. And number two, that halakha does change. Now, the paradigm that I want to use to explain as an example of the issue of religious censorship as a whole is a specific example which appears a few times in the Talmud and brought down in halakha, something called the halakha ve'ein morin ken. I don't know if everybody knows what that phrase means. Halakha is clear, we all know what halakha is. Ve'ein and should not, morin ken should not be taught thus. Now the halakha that is halakha but shouldn't be taught. That's a fascinating idea. Meaning that the pristine halakha, the truth of the legislation, be it Torah legislation, be it rabbinic legislation, is one way. But the ancillary ramifications are too dangerous for it to be taught. And it's better that people not know the pristine true halakha because of the ancillary damage than to know the halakha. And the most famous example of this is actually very well known. It's not the phrase over there is not used exactly the same way, but if you look in Shulchan Aruch, in Hoshin Mishpat, Siman Tav, Chav, okay, which is 425, Siman, hey, Siman 5, you'll see the famous halakha, it's only famous because it's associated with Parsha Shavua, not this Parsha, but the Parsha of Pinchas, and referring to the halakha of Haboel Aramit, Knaim Pogi'im Bo. Okay? Now, this happens to be a secret halakha, so as a result, I'm not going to translate it for you. It's a secret halakha. But the truth is, if you don't know what it means, then you have the opportunity, first of all, to tap your neighbor on the shoulder and ask them, what did you just say? But if you're too embarrassed to do that, because you don't want to show that you don't know what it means, or for other reasons, then when you get home, certainly you'll have the option of calling someone who knows that. You have to make sure you got the phrase right. But you'll either do that, or you can try to look it up. You remember, you said, I said, I have to do something with Pinchas. Or the other opportunity, of course, is to check it out on the internet. And I wanted to make sure that I was correct about that. So I did Google, as a lovely verb, to Google something, right? I Googled the phrase of Haboel Aramit, Knaim Pogi'im Bo, and in fact, six items did come up. Of course, three of them were mine, but that's not so important. But in my articles, I don't translate it either. So you have to look at one of the other three articles that pop up on Google, and you'll be able to find out what it means. In any case, the halakha, when it's secretive, creates a problem in our time. I'll give you an example of when that hit home to me in a kind of ironic fashion. I used to teach what's called a blat shiur, which means that you go through the Gemara, a tractate, page by page, you don't skip anything. It's very common. And the Daf Yomi program, which involves thousands, I don't know how many people are doing Toronto, but around the world, but thousands and thousands of people involved in regular study of every single line in the Talmud. The whole idea is to complete the whole thing without skipping any portions. So I wasn't involved in Daf Yomi per se, but I was giving a shiur, and there are, again, countless shiurim being given across the world that involved the study of the tractate. In this particular case, was the seventh Beitzah, which speaks about the halachot of Yom Tov, of holiday. It was going through this Gemara, and again, going line by line, page by page, and then right in the middle of our study, and mind you, I wasn't teaching scholars. I was teaching what we call Bali Batim, which means people with jobs, people who study on the side, professionals, computer technicians, doctors. I think we did have a doctoral student, but his thesis wasn't in Talmud. Because I was teaching what we call in Israel Amcha, teaching the regular people who presumably we will want to protect from secret halakhot. In any case, in the middle of Masechet Beitzah, I'm sure by the page here, I guess I shouldn't tell which page it's on. In any case, there's a secret halakha in the middle of Masechet Beitzah. It has to be more prosaic, not as exciting as the story of Pinchas. It's talking about sharpening knives. But it's black and white right there for my students to read. And since I trained them well, they were able to read, it created a difficulty on my part that here in theory I was supposed to prevent them from such information. And yet there was very little I could do to prevent such transmission of information. The ink was on the page, and any effort of mine to prevent them from reading it would have just generated more suspicion and more curiosity and more interest in the secrecy of such a halakha. So the cat was out of the bag with my students. My contention this evening, however, is that the cat was out of the bag way before I taught this particular class. And that there have been some fundamental changes in modern society that would, in fact, require us to reevaluate the whole concept of halakha ve'emorim ken. The whole concept of secret halakha, I think, needs to be reevaluated in response to the following variables. The first one is something that's not really a facet of modernity, predates modernity by a few thousand years, and that's the writing down of the Torah Sheba Al Peh. In other words, when halakha was essentially an oral affair, something transmitted by teacher to student, then all the power was really in the hands of the teacher. The teacher chose what to say and chose what not to say. It's very interesting, the story in Beisa, the way it's related to several stories where the teacher tried to keep a secret from the student and told them, this is not the halakha, and then the student was able to catch the teacher performing this halakha in actuality. And that's how the students, in this particular case, they were speaking about Talmid Chachamim, but that's how they discovered the secret halakha. But in any case, in ancient times, when transmission was oral, it was much easier to keep a secret. This problem was only amplified by the invention of the printing press. In other words, in ancient times, even though the Gemara was written, it was only available in very small quantities. And therefore, it would still be manageable to restrict the amount of information. The invention of the printing press, the mass printing press, and the economies of scale that allow mass publications of the Talmud have made this more difficult. But I think if this were the only issue, the only issue that the information is out there in print, I think we could still maintain the secrets of halakha, of halakhot that we would rather keep to ourselves for fear of the damage it might cause if we let them out. But two more changes that I think are more recent and perhaps even more critical than the writing down of the oral law. Second change is educational trends in recent times that we take for granted, that we assume have always been this way, really have not at all. When speaking about his mass education, most men, and certainly women, would not be involved in sophisticated Talmudic and halakhic study. That was reserved for the elite, that was reserved for rabbis and serious scholars, and therefore, even if information was available in theory, it wasn't available in practice. In other words, my students, who would have been woodcutters and storekeepers, would not have had the thought of coming to a shiur, coming to a class of daily study in Gemara. However, because of trends of mass education and because of the popularization of sophisticated study, Talmudic study, which is really a fairly recent phenomenon, we now have all sorts of people who were supposed to be protected from certain information who now have access to this information. And the straw, I think, that breaks the camel's back is what I alluded to before, and that's the advent of mass use of the internet, wherein all sorts of information are available literally at our fingertips. And I think we're ill-advised to ignore the tremendous social changes that are brought about by the revolution that is the internet. When I think of the internet, it reminds me, you know, how many people are old enough to remember
the theme song from Alice's Restaurant. I'm not going to sing it right now because they normally sing it, but normally sing. But in any case, the refrain is you could get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. And I think the same can be said of the internet and the same murky ramifications that exist in one, certainly we know exist in the other. So if you didn't figure out my thesis from the title or from the brief description, it should be clear to you now. The idea that what I call realia, which means facts on the ground, be it technological, be it social, have created changes by which censorship is no longer tenable. As I gave a specific example of halakha ve'im orinkin, but I think this is true of the attempt to censor any information, because once something is available, it becomes extremely difficult to control the flow of that information. And what results in trying to do so is often very counterproductive. If you see, I'm not taking a stand on whether it is a good idea to have certain information censored or not censored in essence. In other words, if we would have a Rabbi Slifkin propounding his theories 2,000 years ago, I would leave it up to whoever had the proper authority to decide whether it's a good thing to censor him or not. Obviously, I have a strong feeling that it's not a good thing, but I'm not coming from that perspective this afternoon. I'm trying to present a halakhic position and say that whoever you are, even if you think it's a good idea, and we saw examples when Chazal, we esteem and feel are the pinnacle of authority, even though we see that they found places where censorship was in order, and in theory censorship has a place in the Jewish tradition, the question is not so much whether specific things should or should not be censored, but whether it's a policy that's possible at all in our times. Good censorship, bad censorship, doesn't make a difference. It simply, according to what I'm suggesting, will not work. And on the contrary, not only will it not work, it will often simply come back to embarrass us. The example of the Slifkin ban, as many of you are familiar with, only created more curiosity about the theories. And again, I think the theories that he propounded are not that controversial, nor are they destructive at all. But that's not really relevant to my point. The people who did feel that it was productive to keep such information away ended up having more people interested in what Rabbi Slifkin had to say. People who otherwise would have likely not picked up the books. And perhaps even more importantly, in terms of what Professor Milano spoke about briefly in the panel discussion, really created a questioning of their own authority by their followers, which also would not have occurred had they not aimed to bring attention to this particular issue by trying to censor the information. The conclusion that one would often get in our time from the attempt to censor something, and perhaps this is a natural human response, is that there is something to hide. And in the case of Rabbi Slifkin, many people who were in the middle of the road were curious as to what it is that the right-wing leadership had to hide. And I have some testimony from one of the people. It's very interesting that the Slifkin affair at least in the United States, before it hit Canada, was very much an internet event. It was emails and websites and blogs continually discussing this issue from all points of view. The tremendous amount of cyberspace developed to the same part is because Redcliffe himself is sophisticated in the use of the internet. But anyways, one of the people that got very much behind in the Slipkin side is a professor, some of you might know him, in Midwestern University, who had a bit of a private correspondence with during the affair, who documented that many of his friends who were professionals, educated, education professional Orthodox Jews, who had identified with the right-wing leadership, and he says, not because they were born into it or took a hardline stance, but simply out of default. We know many people like that who feel that there was no choice if they wanted to be strong in their halachic behavior, and wanted their children to be strong in their halachic behavior and their environment, felt they had no choice but to be identified with the right wing, with the Haredi world, and as a result accepted the authority of the right wing leadership, which is part and parcel of being in the Haredi world. But in any case, he testifies that dozens of his friends and colleagues who were in that situation became very skeptical of the leadership they had adopted, completely reevaluated their standing, and not so much in Judaism, but within the Orthodox world, and came to the realization that for them, there really was, at least on a theoretical level, no home other than modern Orthodox. Again, it doesn't mean that they became modern Orthodox, but again, from the perspective of the Haredi leadership, they certainly paid a price, and they could have paid a much greater price by bringing attention to something that otherwise would have gone much less noticed. Beyond that, there were certain things that were written in response to the Slifkin affair from the Haredi leadership that simply created a situation where they made themselves to look ridiculous. They showed a lack of knowledge of science, of academia, of a variety of notions where they pretended to have expertise, thereby undermining themselves. Essentially, what we have, what we create with censorship that will not work, again, whether you like the specific censorship or not, what you create is a reverse slippery slope. And part of the rationale for the censorship is that there's a certain slippery slope, meaning that Rabbi Sacks or Rabbi Kamenetsky's or Rabbi Slifkin's material in itself doesn't really threaten the faith of an Orthodox Jew. They're certainly staunch Orthodox Jews and are taking positions which, certainly in the case of Rabbi Slifkin, are legitimate positions that have been expounded before by other leading Orthodox Jews and rabbis and scholars. But the fear is that once they start here, once they start questioning the literal meaning of the text, of the biblical text, and this is the two main heresies of Rabbi Slifkin, so-called heresies. One is doubting the literal meaning of the biblical text, and two, doubting the omniscience of Chazal, meaning of the rabbis and Talmud, meaning saying that it's possible for them to make mistakes. So again, this is not a new position. The Rambam, for one, strongly argues for both of those positions. But the fear is that the modern, not modern Orthodox, but the contemporary Orthodox society is not able to be nuanced enough to understand that it doesn't mean that anything goes. Once you question the literal interpretation of the text, then anything goes. Once you say that Chazal, the rabbis, could have been wrong, then they could be wrong about anything. That's the most potent and most central rationale behind a lot of the censorship. But in fact, there's also a reverse slippery slope, which may be even more powerful. And Rabbi Sudan shared this with me. I don't recall if he shared it in his session this morning, but he said that people come to him and give a specific example of Lubavitchers, they said others as well, that once they feel they're lied to about one thing, then they question the entire integrity of the Orthodox leadership, meaning their specific Orthodox leadership in the particular case that he was speaking about. The discussion being that of whether the Lubavitcher Rebbe was the Mashiach or not. Once it comes to the attention that Lubavitcher's son, not his small group, that the facts do not bear this out, then they lose faith in the Lubavitch leadership, at least that wing of Lubavitch leadership altogether. And once they lose that faith, it's a short process to losing all faith. So censorship, when it's a good thing, is only a good thing when it's effective. When it's not effective, even if intrinsically it's good, it ipso facto becomes a negative strategy, simply because we're going to be caught. In a book that I've just recently written, speak about the biblical figures in Sefer Bereishit, I point out that a great deal was made out of Yehuda's admission to having had a questionable relationship with Tamar. A tremendous amount is made of this in the rabbinic literature. He becomes a tremendous hero for something that's ostensibly a singular event. One of the things that's pointed out in the literature is that it's not only a moral victory, but it's a question of sage leadership. To admit what you've done wrong, simply to admit the truth, is a wise move for leadership, lest they be caught in having tried to have concealed something. And we know from unfortunate political scandals recently in Israel, in other countries as well, this is a leitmotif, unfortunately, of politicians throughout the world. It's more embarrassing when it exists in our own state of Israel. But we know that trying to hide negative information, if it comes out, is much more destructive than admitting such information. I just want to close with one more point, and that is that if I'm correct, and the idea of halacha b'imorimken is no longer tenable, we still have a responsibility to relate to the concern of the rabbis. And as the rabbis correctly pointed out, that there's certain halachot, there's certain information that is destructive. It's better for people not to have that information. I've just said, there's nothing we can do about it. Information is going to get to the people anyways. So the question becomes, what do we do now? What do we do about dangerous halakhot, such as what I said before, originally, the question of imitating Pinchas. And we know that a few decades ago, that long, less than 20 years ago, it's a man named Baruch Goldstein who looked at Pinchas as a role model. Granted, that was more symbolic than halachic. He wasn't speaking about the exact same situation, but nonetheless, perhaps more recently, again, we commemorated the murder of Yitzhak Rabin just a couple of days ago. There also was a situation where certain rabbis were presenting halachot that, assuming they were right, and I question that, that's not really important, assuming they were right, An important question is whether they should have been teaching these halachot. So the question is an appropriate question. When you have dangerous material, potentially dangerous material, in halacha, and it can't be stopped, if the rabbis don't teach it, the students are going to get it from the internet, then what do you do about such information? I think the answer to that is that we have to turn to what is one of our favorite subjects at the Pardoza Academy, where we offer leadership training to educators, is that we have to really buckle up in the world of Jewish education. In other words, if you can't avoid certain information reaching students, you have to present it in the best way possible, wherein they will understand exactly what are appropriate ramifications of the halakha and what are not appropriate ramifications of the halakha. Incidentally, this is true not only in halakha, an area that's become very popularized recently is the world of Kabbalah, the world of Jewish mysticism, wherein texts are available to everyone, as we know, which means to our children as well. And whether we think it's a good idea for our children to be versed in Kabbalah or not, by the way, Rav Kook was a proponent of teaching Kabbalah to the masses at a young age in our time, this time. But whatever side of the divide we are on this issue, it is well advised for the educational system to respond and to teach it the way that we want it taught. It's truly a challenge. It's something that I feel, however, must be done because we have no other choice. On the other hand, moving from censorship to education, I believe, positions us properly to compete in the free marketplace of ideas that, like it or not, we're all a part of. And from a religious point of view, this forces our hand, I think, in a very positive direction to what has been described as the Dor De'ah, a generation that has complete knowledge, enlightened knowledge, which will, and God willing, pave the way for true messianic times.
If there are questions, are we going to do the next one? Sorry.
Do you believe that we owe the great apostate for decades a certain amount of deference? We're deciding whether or not we want to expose ourselves to potentially hazardous material?
I didn't hear the question.
Here in Toronto, the solicitor there was pretty much in the spotlight. I'm asking you, do we not owe a certain amount of deference to people in our community that have demonstrated abilities to that have been doing it for decades and decades? And when we're deciding whether or not to read this material, is it not appropriate to ask them their opinion on it?
We're taking all the questions first.
Well, just take it to one at a time.
Yeah, so it's a good question. What attitude should we have towards people who are competent leaders in halakha who we disagree with? And I don't think that we can simply dismiss the opinion of halakhic experts. By the same token, I don't know that we're obligated to follow such poskim if either we have poskim of our own that differ, which I think do exist in certain ways, we ourselves are on a level of competence in a certain area of halakha. That's in terms of what to do. In other words, do I have to listen to them or don't I have to listen to them? So if we're competent individually, obviously very few of us are, or we have poskim that we usually go to, again, that we're not looking for a specific post-set simply to allow us to do what we want to do, so it's certainly legitimate to follow in a position that differs with these poskim. As far as kavod, it's talking about do we need to express honor for these poskim? We do need to express honor for who they are. By the same token, there's a principle of in a place where there's a chilul Hashem created, it's not appropriate to give honor. In other words, if the poskim make a mockery of themselves by presenting something that's I have an example, I'd rather not present it because I'm trying to uphold the honor of the poskim, where they clearly make themselves look ridiculous to the outside world. For us to say, I can't judge that when we are in a position clearly to judge, I think is also inappropriate and simply serves to the detriment of the honor of the Torah.
Thank you very much. I just want to remark that my understanding of halacha ben morikin is entirely different. There are no secrets in the family. And so we're not presented with a problem with the fact that now we need to get information. Halacha ben morikin, there are different levels of discussion of halacha in the family. There's something called halacha lemaisa as opposed to halacha. So that if I tell you halacha ben morikin, I simply mean, yes, this is correct, but I am not going to spread it in public. I'm not going to have a public drasha at the Kala where thousands of people are there and I'm going to tell this information. For instance, in the case of Pinchas, the issue there is you have to have that inner feeling. If you're already asking a question, then you're not strong enough about it, so you don't have the heter to do it. So really, this is, there are no secrets. A look away Morikin does not mean a secret or dangerous. You also imply that the entire concept of Rodei is a dangerous concept. But we believe in Rodei. There's a Moser. It implies nowadays as well. Of course, it's a dangerous halacha. But there is a halacha of Rodei. And it certainly applies today. So, it's a very different opinion.
First of all, it's correct with Pinchas. I said the formulation is a little different. If you look at the formulation of Gemara Shacharu, it's Abali Maleh Emorim Lokim, which is not exactly the formulation that appears in other places. Which means, as you said, if the person is not decided enough as well as knowledgeable enough on his own, it means that he can't do it. As far as the difference between not publicizing something and something being censored, I'm not sure that I appreciate the difference.
It's very simple. If there, well, you can read thousands of Mishnayos that have the word halacha, but that doesn't mean the halacha is particularly that way. Both the Basar Kuflama, the Talmud is very specific. Ain lemeidam halacha from general statements, you must have a specific halacha lemaisa, which means that we don't necessarily, this may be our opinion, but we're not going to spread it in a public brush out. To the commonplace.
Right.
To the commonplace.
I will continue the debate, but I want to get to the next question.
I think it's clear that in the internet era, it's very difficult to control the flow of information and, for that matter, misinformation, what is out there. But I think the one thing we internet hasn't changed is the ability of people in positions of authority to suppress information that is sourced, which is correct. And I think we see that Wahhab deal in a rampant way in the Islamic world. But I think also we see it in our own backyard when we, you know, by the application of instruments like Sarah and so on. People in positions of authority are able to impose self-censorship on the sources of information.
I would say there's different, I was going to refer to the issue of self-censorship. I don't think from the source of information, once the information is out, in other words, you're right that authorities were able to get Rabbi Sacks and Rabbi Kamenetsky to backtrack, but the original information is there and widely accessible. So I'm not sure it is correct that there is authority, and perhaps that would be a wise use of authority if one believes in censorship in those particular cases, to get to the information before it's printed, before it's diffused. And you're correct that there still exists some authority there. Another area which is more appropriate, I think, is the issue of self-censorship. I mean, if Poskim tell their followers, you know, it's out there, and I'm not going to tell the publisher not to print it, I'm not going to tell the stores not to sell it, but I'm going to tell my followers not to read it, because I'm telling you it's not good for you. So that, I think, is entirely appropriate. That I have no problem with. We have, we all must censor certain things to ourselves, to our children. I don't think that's a problem. I think the problem is trying to suppress information that is already out in the Google bans that I mentioned.
Just to follow up, I know it's like, I think you missed the point of the last question, was that when I think of an idea 10 years from now, I'm not going to publish it. So no one's going to know my idea, they might know Sylvan's idea. And to add to that, the success will still be that if I know that the Sylvan's books have been banned, then it's not going to become found in the houses of the teachers of the schools. And my kids are not going to find out, and at least in their schools until they're much older, about such ideas. They're going to think that's anathema to Judaism, and it's not going to be found. So there could be success in future censorship, and for the children not finding out, or only finding out at an older age when they're already been indoctrinated, that it's forbidden. So I think, although I might disagree with the censorship, I think censorship does work on some degree, on some level.
So in terms of intimidating people to write in the future, I agree there's a point there, and it's a somewhat scary point that people are intimidated from speaking their mind. Because I'm referring to information specifically as opposed to the potential for information. As far as whether our children will have more access or less access as a result of the censorship, again, I would take the Slipkin affair as an example. You're right, there's a trade-off. There's certainly schools that would have had it that won't have it. But my evaluation is that there's going to be more people that would not have had it that would have it as a result, including children, including...
I think it's a difference between short-term and long-term. I'm not sure either.
But I'm also not sure that that's the idea of the post-scheme that are involved, is to prevent damage in the long term. Maybe it is, maybe you're right, and that's the vision. Except that is an open question.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Natta.
There's information about the Academy, and anybody wants to be on our weekly mailing list, should be invited to sign here with lots of information.